Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. What was initially envisioned to be a three-day special military operation in February of 2022 has quickly turned into a brutal, years-long war with quick land grabs and sporadic operations. The Russia-Ukraine war has lasted more than 3.5 years, and with every new development, we're left asking, what needs to be done to resolve the conflict? Recently, President Trump met with Russian leader Vladimir Putin here in America to discuss ceasefire terms. But many other developments have taken place around the Russia-Ukraine war. Joining us now is Joanna Kakissis, NPR's Ukraine correspondent in Kyiv. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So we should start with the latest news. Over the weekend, Russia attacked Ukraine with 800 drones. This was the largest attack since the war began, actually. But did this come as a surprise since Putin and Trump had recently been discussing a ceasefire?
It didn't come as a surprise to the Ukrainians because they feel like the Russians always don't negotiate in good faith anyway and don't honor whatever verbal agreements have been made. And the escalation has been happening for several months now. Like, the record is broken every 6 weeks or so. It didn't come as a surprise at all here. I remember I just had gotten back into town after a break immediately heard the air raid sirens, and I thought, oh, I wonder what this is going to be. And then the next morning I woke up, saw smoke billowing and read the news and saw that, yes, another record had been broken.
Yeah. Can you tell me what an attack by 800 drones means? I guess I don't understand. Do the drones drop bombs?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're Shahed style drones. They look like small airplanes. And I actually heard one flying right over. I mean, it was really loud. It woke me up. It sounds like a really, really loud lawnmower, if you can imagine. Some of them are equipped with explosives, but they crash into buildings and they cause an enormous amount of damage. So what happens is you have air defense units running around. Some of them are mobile, some of them are located in certain locations. You have like Patriot style anti-missile launchers. You have guys on trucks with mounted machine guns shooting at these drones, trying to remove them from the sky. So that's what's happening. And most recently, Ukraine has been introducing interceptor drones, which destroy and disable the drones in the sky. So some of the damage that Kyiv, for example, sees in buildings with high rises come from the debris of the drones, because the burning remnants like fall onto buildings and cause damage. And that actually happened at a government building for the first time. It's the place where President Volodymyr Zelensky's cabinet meets, and it was destroyed. So parts of the building were heavily damaged.
Yeah, the area that was attacked seems strategic because it involved government buildings. But it surprised me, after a 3.5 year war, this was the first government building that actually was severely destroyed.
Yeah, it's the first one in Kyiv. There have been government buildings in other parts of Ukraine that have been badly damaged and destroyed, and people have died. But in this case, this is the first time a government building in the headquarters, in Zelensky's very heavily protected headquarters, was hit. Now, I have heard reports there have been conflicting reports that it was the debris of a drone that fell on the building, and there have also been reports that it was a missile that hit the building. So that's still being sorted out, but it is very unusual. It's the first time that Kyiv's government sector has been hit.
As someone in America observing this war from afar, it seems like an on-again, off-again conflict, how it's covered in the media here. But you're there on the ground. Does it feel like it's been an active war every day for 3 years?
actually, yeah. It does feel that way because especially in the last couple of years when Kyiv's been under attacks a lot because it, you know, early in the war, the first year of the war, the whole country felt like it was mm-hmm. under siege. But then later it was like the war ended up being concentrated in the east or in the southeast. But now Kyiv is attacked pretty regularly. And so it does feel that way. It does feel, people ask me all the time if I'm scared, but I think I've just gotten used to it at this point. I know how to protect myself. And so does everyone else in Kyiv. We all lose sleep, of course, because these attacks often happen overnight. But yeah, people are tired, but people have also accepted that this is their day-to-day life. I have lots of friends here who just find workarounds around the war and say like, well, this is the way it's going to be right now until we can hopefully get a settlement that works for Ukraine.
Mm. In a recent piece you did for NPR, you said Ukraine is making a lot of its own weapons now. Is that because mm-hmm. the country cannot rely on America or Europe continuously for help?
Well, I mean, the problem is that that there have been delays in these weapons. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the reliance is an issue. Mm-hmm. Relying on the West has been an issue. And so because the Russians are arming themselves and they also have partners who don't delay in weapons, like the North Koreans and for a while the Iranians had no problem sending weapons, Shahed drones or Iranian-designed drones. The North Koreans have signed a strategic partnership with Russia. And so Russia was managing to increase its arsenal, but the Ukrainians weren't. So they very quickly pulled together a defense industry that is booming now. I mean, and very, very high tech as well. Like there are robots on the battlefield. There was recently, I think it was earlier this summer, there was actually just a group of robots that surrounded a group of Russian soldiers, and the Russian soldiers surrendered to the robots, you know. So it's
wow.
It's crazy how high the level of innovation has been in a short amount of time. And there are lots of investors who are interested in it, and lots of European countries that are watching how Ukraine develops its defense industry. But yeah, the big issue was we need to protect ourselves. Our partners have been slow in providing shells, weapons, and so we need to do it ourselves.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Russia-Ukraine war with Joanna Kakissis, NPR's Ukraine correspondent in Kyiv. So recently, President Trump met with Russian leader Vladimir Putin in Alaska, famously. Mm-hmm. What is your take on this meeting? Did anything really come of it?
From the perspective of Ukraine, no. I know President Zelensky has said in a recent interview, I believe with NBC News, I'm not sure if that it was NBC News, but with an American network, he mm-hmm. said pretty recently that it feels like Putin got everything he wanted in that meeting. And it was a meeting that worked for Russia. The Ukrainians don't understand why there is an additional pressure put on, like action, not just words, but actions. Why don't you add sanctions? Why don't you try to squeeze Ukraine in a way, squeeze Russia in a way that helps Ukraine and helps secure some kind of ceasefire that will last. The issue has been for many years with Russia and Ukraine is that Russia has not been sort of obligated to follow certain rules under ceasefires, like past ceasefires in 2014 and 2015, the Minsk agreements, for example. And then even going back even further to the Budapest agreement, when Ukraine was forced to give up its nuclear, not was told to give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees from the West and Russia. I mean, that never materialized because, of course, Russia invaded Crimea, took over Crimea in 2014, and helped separatists take over East Ukraine. So this idea that Russia doesn't honor ceasefires and doesn't seem to want peace is something deeply ingrained in the Ukrainian perspective. So unless they see like more sanctions, tougher sanctions, mm-hmm. something, some action in addition to the words, they're not going to see it as a victory.
one of the reasons the conflict has lasted so long involves the demands from both Ukraine and Russia before a ceasefire will be reached. What are the most recent Ukrainian demands? What are they saying is a deal breaker?
Well, the Ukrainians want territorial integrity, which means that they want their territory back, which, of course, Russia doesn't want to give up the territory that it's managed to take over very slowly over the past 3.5 years. And the other issue with Ukraine is it wants ironclad, if I can, for lack of a better word, security guarantees. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, they want Western partners to convince Russia to accept these kinds of terms, like maybe it's peacekeeping forces, maybe it's some sort of ironclad security guarantee that will prevent Russia from continuing its invasion of Ukraine to moving further into the country. So that is two of the biggest issues for them, and Russia has said we don't want anything to do with peacekeeping forces, and we're not giving up the land. So it seems like a non-starter. Like, we can't move beyond that.
Yeah, and then from Russia's side, since they won't agree to those terms, what they want the land.
They want the territory, and they want Ukraine to demilitarize. They want Ukraine to give up its NATO ambitions. Ukraine's response is, we're not going to demilitarize when you remain a threat. Mm. And Ukraine is making no moves to demilitarize because they don't trust the Russians to observe peace in any sort of good faith. Like, let's say the Ukrainians have argued this way. They've said, we demilitarize, we give up our NATO ambitions. Does that mean Russia is going to honor its promises? It's never honored them in the past. So why should we make those moves?
I heard an interesting report on the BBC NewsHour last week. A reporter traveled to the other side of Russia, the side that's closer to China and South Korea, thousands of miles from where you are, and talked to people who live on that other side of Russia if they had an opinion about Ukraine. And the whole thing seemed very distant. Everyone he interviewed didn't really care about the conflict. Does that surprise you is Russia such a big country? Does it surprise you that the other side of Russia doesn't care about Ukraine?
No, it doesn't just surprise me. As you mentioned, it's a big country, and it's a country that is, sort of in the grip of disinformation. most of the news and facts that filter down to Russians are not facts at all, and they're not, it's not reality. And so many people in the far corners of Russia don't really even know what's happening in Ukraine. So they don't care because they don't know what's happening. And so, no, I'm not surprised at all. I would expect that, actually, in Russia.
What about people who live on the other side of Ukraine, maybe closer to Poland or Hungary? Does the entire country of Ukraine feel engaged in this conflict, or is it just people living in the cities that are being attacked?
No, the entire country is engaged in this. And I was just in Western Ukraine for a wedding, and everywhere you go in Western Ukraine, people talk about it. And even places like in Uzhhorod, for example, which is on the border with Slovakia, there's no curfew there. It never gets bombed, but people there all still talk about it because the way the Ukrainians have framed this war is it's an existential war for them. It's a fight for becoming part of the West and subscribing to this idea of liberal democracy with checks and balances that protect civil liberties, that protect individual rights, that protect sovereignty, and so they're willing to stake their very survival on this. So I have not met Ukrainians who don't care. I mean, everyone cares about this war, even if it's in a place in far Western Ukraine that doesn't get bombed. People do care.
We hear all the time President Zelensky talking about what he hopes and expects from America and the European Union. What does the average Ukrainian want from America and the European Union when it comes to this war?
I think from the US, they want a partner that will not let Russia bully them. They want security from the United States. The United States has provided this role in the past as this counterbalance to Russia, and has protected Ukraine from Russia to some extent. I mean, specifically talking about the Biden administration, because previous administrations were sort of wishy-washy about that. Now, from the European Union, I think, you know, the relationship is different because the Ukraine is on a trajectory to join the European Union, mm-hmm. and it already sort of sees itself as part of Western Europe and part of this team of nations that also subscribe to liberal democracy and also mm-hmm. believe in the idea of preserving civil liberties and sovereignty and working together. And so what they want from the European, what they want from the European Union is probably a clearer and more robust welcoming into the European Union soon. I mean, the people say, oh yeah, you'll be part of the family, but they want like a date, like they'd you'll be part of the European Union in 2 years or something, or in 5 years, or they want more clarity. But I think the relationship with the Europeans is much better than at the moment than Ukraine's relationship with the United States.
Just as a final question, after this latest attack of 800 drones over the weekend, do you think a ceasefire is even farther away than it was before the Alaska meeting?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just, that's a good question. And I don't think it's just this, the attacks. I think it's just that the things that both countries want, that Russia and Ukraine want, they're not workable. You can't, there's no compromise there. They're not going to compromise in either of the requirements that they have for a ceasefire. Mm. And so, yeah, the attacks will continue, which is terrible for Ukraine. But I think that those root causes, those root issues need to be addressed first. And I'm not sure that they can be.
I want to thank you so much for your time today. Joanna Kakissis is NPR's Ukraine correspondent in Kyiv. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of the Ukraine-Russia conflict with a professor who has spent his career studying Russian politics and Russian foreign policy. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
A report called Out of Reach shows that the average Columbus renter cannot afford a 2-bedroom apartment in the city. Another report shows that Columbus has fewer affordable housing units than New York and San Francisco. We're talking about increasing rent and what can be done about it. And then a look at modern cheerleading. It's more than pom-poms and cartwheels. It's a massive industry that some say has grown dangerous. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jarovich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. When Russia initially invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, it caught many people off guard. Despite months of warnings from intelligence reports, no one expected such a large-scale advancement from multiple directions. However, since 2014, many experts have been sounding alarm bells that this was not only a prediction, but something fully expected after Russia's annexation of Crimea. Now, 3.5 years later, the two countries continue to seem far apart on a ceasefire agreement. But to understand how we got here and why things have not been resolved, you need to understand the deeper history between Russia and Ukraine. And you need to examine the Russian-American relationship, too. Joining us now is George Hudson, a retired professor of political science at Wittenberg University, also the founder of the Russian and Central Eurasia Studies program at Wittenberg. And he taught as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. Professor Hudson, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Amy. Nice to be with you today.
So, with this war reaching its 3.5 year mark, where do you see the conflict right now? Overall, is it a stalemate or is it something else, in your opinion?
Well, I think a stalemate is probably a pretty good term, although Russia has advanced somewhat into more Ukrainian territory. But really, things aren't moving a lot. All that's happening is a lot of destruction. It's a real tragedy. Just the last couple of days, Russia has upped its drone attacks, and over the past few months, they've increased even more. Of course, Ukraine isn't sitting by either, and so they're fighting back, and so the war goes on.
Yeah, we just talked with Joanna Kakissis, NPR's reporter in Ukraine, in Kyiv, and she said that Ukraine is now making their own weapons. They're making their own drones. They're making robot soldiers. A very modern technological war we have going on here. What do you make of all that?
Well, it is definitely a new stage, and probably the most important thing is the drone technology. And the Ukrainians have been very inventive, I must say, about protecting themselves and making their own drones. But the Russians aren't standing by either. They borrowed the design from Iran to make their drones, and so it's certainly not a completely a drone warfare, because there's lots of people dying in armed combat and sort of normal infantry units. But the new technology is quite interesting, and lots of countries are taking note of it, including the United States. And so we're developing our own drones as well, although we have been doing that for a while for sure. But this just shows how shall I say, useful they can be in warfare.
Take us back to February of 2022. What Vladimir Putin said publicly about why he initially invaded Ukraine. At that time, did you take him at his word, or is there always something deeper going on with Putin?
Oh, there's a lot of deeper things going on here. In fact, that's the main point I think I would like to make this morning, which is that the geopolitical context is probably the most important thing for us to think about when we're analyzing the war. In other words, Vladimir Putin is using territorial gains, such as the ones that he can make, in order to advance a larger cause. And Ukraine is defending itself also to advance a larger cause. So it's the geopolitics, and that cause is, on the one hand, on Russia's hand, Russia would love to divide the West. This has been since Soviet times. Part of Russian foreign policy. And also, Putin would like to sort of take things back, if he can, to the good old days of the USSR, and see if Russia can have a significant influence not only over Ukraine, but over all the countries that border it, and even ones to the south, just like the USSR. He'd also have an even broader goal, which is to be able to get together with the United States and sort of form a two huge powers controlling world events. Needless to say, a lot of this is pipe dream. But certainly, in a more limited way, he wants to get a lot more influence in at least part of the area that used to be the USSR. So that's the broader geopolitical context. Ukraine, on its hand, on its side, would very much like to integrate more and more with the West, to become a member of the European Union, to become a member of NATO, and really become a sort of a solid Western partner, if you will. And so the war is really being at its base conducted on those terms. To put it another way, territorial gains, which is what we're all looking at, are only instrumental. And if we focus just on the territory that Russia gets, a bit of this and a bit of that of Eastern Ukraine, I think we're missing the whole point. It's a much broader geopolitical battle that's going on here.
Yeah, it does seem anytime a ceasefire is talked about, the territory is talked about, and Russia is such a huge country, more than 5,000 miles long. So I think it's hard for someone as a casual observer in America to think about like why this tiny piece, not even all of Ukraine, but a piece of Ukraine matters so much in the bigger picture of Russia being more than 5,000 miles long. Why? Yeah, why?
Well, it's merely more of a symbol. And that tiny piece, by the way, our listeners would like to hear, is almost exactly the same size as Ohio.
Yeah. All right.
Though
I'll
it's
take it.
not the
Yeah.
same shape. And so, I mean, for Ohioans, I mean, that seems like a lot of land, but it really, of course, isn't. It's 20% of Ukraine. And of course, it hurts. And that includes Crimea. Crimea, which is in the southern part that Russia occupied in 2014. But it's the territory is really secondary when we're looking at the basic reasons for why people are fighting.
The average Russian citizen, Russia is such a huge country. I don't even know if there is an average Russian citizen because it depends, I guess, where you are and what information you're getting. But how do you think the average Russian citizen feels about Ukraine?
Well, it's really interesting. There have been public opinion polls, and something like 75% of Russians support the army. And you can read that. That's the way the question was asked. And you can read that as 75% support the war in Ukraine. The public opinion polls, of course, are very difficult to interpret and very difficult to give in Russia under these conditions with an authoritarian political system. But the Levada Center, I think, does a pretty good job. At least it's the best thing that we have to go on. President Putin is quite a popular guy, furthermore. He has, it was an 86% popularity rating. Do you like the way he's doing his job? 86% said yes. any American politician would give his right arm to get a population. To get
Yeah.
a popularity rating like that. And Putin's is down, by the way, over the last few months from 88%.
Can that 86% be trusted? Is the polling like can it be trusted, or is it being conducted by Putin government officials and people are just saying, sure, yes, we're happy.
Excuse me. No, it's not being conducted by Putin's government officials. It's being conducted by the Levada Center, which is about as independent a polling organization as you can get in Russia. And what they do is they go into people's homes and they ask questions like, do you think Putin's doing a good job or not? Even so, I mean, if somebody comes into your apartment and says, well, how's President Putin doing? And you know the con or at least people imagine what the consequences of a negative answer would be. They're going to think twice before they say, well, he's doing a lousy job or whatever. So, there's always those polling problems that are happening in Russia today. But nevertheless, it gives us kind of an idea. So Putin's pretty popular. I think it's pretty clear that the very least we can say is that the war is popular. And in cities like Moscow, which have been all dressed up and looking good, and people walk around and there are little amusing things to do around the city. And this is probably true for St. Petersburg as well, the two largest cities in Russia. People saying, well, what war? The New York Times, oh, a few days ago, had a really good article on this. And one of the things that it said was that those attitudes are criticized by pro-war Russians on their blogs. Say, Russians aren't aware of the sacrifices that we're making, and they're huge. And, what is all of this amusing stuff with carousels and popcorn and so on and so forth? So there is some internal activity going on in Russia that I would say the pro-war bloggers are very critical of.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Ukraine-Russia war with Professor George Hudson, retired professor of political science at Wittenberg University. He also taught as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. You were also in a faculty affiliate at OSU's Mershon Center for International Security Studies. So when you think about security, specifically Russian security, and what Russia is facing now, there's been a lot of cyber attacks. There's economic instability. But most of this, like the cyber attacks, the economic instability, is related to the war in Ukraine. Do you think that some people surrounding Putin are worried about these things like cyber attacks?
Well, probably they are. They might be worried about it. But Putin, for all I can see, is pretty well ensconced in power. He seems, at least his external demeanor, seems to show a lot of confidence in himself. I have not seen any rumblings of any problems. People might be worried about cyber attacks, but these do not seem to me, at least, to be a huge worry for Putin. More worrisome are other things. For instance, the casualties, Russian casualties, are very high. There's something like, according to the Institute for the Study of War, Russian casualties since the beginning of the conflict in February are about either 660,000 or 990,000 killed and wounded.
I had no idea it was that high. Okay.
It is incredibly high and stunning. Ukraine's, by the way, are about half that. This is really a disaster for the society. And when you add on to that the population decline in Russia, Russia's population could, in the next 75 years, decline by as much as 40%. Which is astounding. You combine the war losses, the population decline, and the large number of Russian men who left the country as soon as the war began. Wow. This is really a recipe for catastrophe for Russia. That is something that they're worrying about. Putin himself has talked about population decline and has tried to institute policies, to make more babies and all of that. That never works.
Did men leave Russia in big numbers so that they wouldn't have to participate in the war?
Absolutely. And not only just men, this is tens of thousands left. And it isn't only men, but it's men that have technical skills. And they find themselves now living in countries like Georgia and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and many of what we know as the former Soviet republics, the new countries that were founded after the USSR dissolved. But they live down there, creating their own social tensions in some of those countries, I might add. But they're out. And others migrated abroad to Europe. A lot of the Soviet, or I'm sorry, a lot of the Russian media is being run from abroad. They broadcast in to Russia from England and places like that. A friend of mine was the editor-in-chief of the Moscow Times, and he upped his family and they moved to London He's still doing his work on reporting, and the Moscow Times still publishes, but it's a very difficult thing for journalists in Russia today.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Russia-Ukraine war. And after the break, we're going to dive a little bit more into history, dating back to the Soviet Union. Staying with us is Professor George Hudson, retired professor of political science at Wittenberg University. He also taught as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. We'll be back in just a moment. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The Russia-Ukraine war is one that has been building for a while, with tensions arising since the fall of the Soviet Union, with one country's push toward the West and the other country's push toward itself. Conflict has been brewing for decades. Russia wants to keep Ukraine away from NATO and the European Union, but NATO countries were fearful of Russian aggression. It's a delicate balancing act. Even more complicated is Russia's power structure, which allows its leader, Vladimir Putin, to execute authority over the entire country based on years of political maneuvering. Still with us is George Hudson, a retired professor of political science from Wittenberg University, also the founder of the Russian and Central Eurasia Studies program at Wittenberg, and he taught as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. Professor Hudson, thank you again for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
So you served as an advisor on Soviet affairs at the Department of Defense in the 70s. Are there any similarities between how the Soviet Union acted then and how Russia is acting now?
Well, actually, that's a really great question. And it's a debatable one, to tell you the truth. Scholars go back and forth on this. From my side of things, anyway, I see a lot of continuity from Soviet times till now. Not that the country is exactly the same, because it obviously isn't. For instance, Putin is no Stalin. He's pretty bad, but Stalin he's not. Nevertheless, Soviet foreign policy back in the 50s and the post-war period really was aimed at trying to separate out the Western countries, to, you know, take France away from NATO. France had already shown signs of not wanting to be in NATO's command structure. For instance, Putin tried to, I beg your pardon, Khrushchev and the Soviet leaders after him tried to use that as a lever to try to keep Soviet influence up. Ukraine was always there as a problem, I might add. Speaking of Khrushchev, Khrushchev was the Communist Party leader that was in charge of Ukraine. And during Stalin's time, Khrushchev was responsible for executing and some pretty a large number of Ukrainians. I don't know, I can't tell you the number, but it was a pretty brutal Khrushchev. But then when Khrushchev became the head of the Soviet Communist Party, he was a little bit nicer. He tried to pursue a policy of that was not as brutal as Stalin. And indeed, under him, he gave Crimea, which was part of the Russian Federation, to Ukraine as a present.
Yeah, great present. He should have said no take backsies.
But back then it didn't matter because the country was so centrally run by the Communist Party. It didn't matter if, what part of the country Crimea was in. So he just gave it. And of course, quite obviously, Putin came to regret this very, very much. Furthermore, in Ukraine had had a long history, especially after World War II, of terror groups erupting in Western Ukraine that would attack Communist Party officials. And they had to really crack down as best as they could. Ukraine has been a problem, shall I say, even during Soviet times, when we're looking back at history, and the Soviet leadership and now the Russian leadership is having to deal with Ukraine as a real problem.
Is that why Ukraine is taking the brunt of this? Because there's plenty of other countries that broke off from the Soviet Union and became their own countries. But why is Ukraine where we're in a 3.5 year war?
Right. Well, first it was Georgia in 2008, and there was a 5 day war there, which ended up Georgia had to cede about 20% of its territory to Russia. But I'm sorry, I'm losing the question there again, please.
Oh, why Ukraine as opposed to other countries? Because there's
Oh, why
plenty of,
Ukraine? Well, it's big.
yeah.
There are strong historical ties between Russia and Ukraine. Lots of Russians, for instance, including friends of mine, have their summer homes in Ukraine. And when the country broke up, I talked to a number of them during one of my many, many visits, and they were just shaking their heads, saying for things like, "Can you imagine? I have to cross an international boundary to get to my summer home." Or, when you get to the boundary, the Russian Ukrainians who were guarding the border there, if there were guards at all, I might add, were wearing kind of a mishmash of old Soviet uniforms, new Ukrainian. I mean, they didn't, it was just weird to Russians. And many were extremely upset about this, many, including Russians whom you would, might label as liberals.
How do you feel Ukraine has been able to hold off Russia for so long? I mean, we talked about the size of Ukraine versus the size of Russia, but it's been 3.5 years. How do you feel that how is Ukraine able to sustain?
Well, first of all, and the most important factor is the gutty performance that Ukrainian soldiers have had to oppose Russian soldiers. It takes a 3-to-1 ratio of attackers to defenders in order for the attackers to achieve something. Ukraine has seemed to even bested that. So they've been really gutty performers. Ukraine has also gotten a lot of aid and assistance, including from the United States, of course, and from Western Europe to shore up its armed forces. So those are two important factors that the Ukrainians have had on their side. Another one has been the absolute idiocy, especially at the beginning, of the Russian soldiers who attacked Ukraine in the first place. They didn't really know what they were doing. Many of the soldiers had no idea, literally, where they were and what they were supposed to do. And Ukrainians took advantage of this by especially as a lot of the tactical warfare Russians made mistakes and lost large numbers of soldiers. So that also helped Ukraine for sure.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Russia-Ukraine war with Professor George Hudson, retired political science professor from Wittenberg University. I can't believe we got this far into our conversation and I haven't asked you about the Alaska meeting. What did you make of the Putin-Trump meeting in Alaska whenever you heard about that?
Well, my term for it is half-baked Alaska.
That's lovely. I haven't heard that one before. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason I say that is that it was half in a way because, well, President Trump succeeded in getting Putin to come and meet with him to talk peace, for which I think that's great that he tried. However, it was half-baked because there was almost no preparation in advance for this meeting. And when you have a huge summit like this, it's usually, and I think must be, preceded by months of talks at lower levels, so that when the meeting does take place, most everything is decided. And that didn't happen.
Well, that doesn't seem like that's not how President Trump works.
He just kind of does it and see what goes.
Yeah.
And that's in many different spheres, as our listeners know. But another thing, I'm trying to think of the other reason. Trump had said, well, we're going to have a ceasefire. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ceasefire to establish trust. Good idea. However, Putin came, and we saw this image of an American president greeting a war criminal on a red carpet on American soil, which was, in my view, disgusting. We're going to have a wonderful ceasefire, establish trust, and get this thing going. Well, Putin had no intention of having a ceasefire, as has been obvious the last few days, as I think I mentioned before. And the result of the meeting was that there was no result. There was no ceasefire. Mm-hmm. Trump changed his tune. I don't know what went on in those rooms, the two of them, but Trump stopped talking about a ceasefire, whereas before he was talking about it. So that's another reason that was half-baked.
Mm. There's been lots of reports that countries like France, Germany, the UK have increased their military spending, and they're worried about possible Russian aggression. Do you see Putin taking this Ukraine conflict to other countries? Is it going to expand?
Well, the short answer is no, not in the near term. If I were living in Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, I would be worried about that. Mm-hmm. If I were living in France, I wouldn't be. France has nuclear weapons too. I don't think so, but there's always not the threat of invasion, really. Mm-hmm. It's the threat of increased influence over what goes on. And that's where Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Georgia, these countries are quite concerned that Russia would have strong influence over their policies. And I believe it's the Latvians are the only ones that have, I believe there are some Latvians who are fighting in Ukraine, and Latvia is giving assistance to Ukraine. So, mm-hmm. Predicting that, anything beyond Russia's efforts to increase its influence, I don't see any military threat coming in. But what the Europeans want to do, and they have recently gotten together in conferences and have agreed that after the conflict ends, they're going to provide a lot of support, but only after it ends.
Mm.
The trick is, how do you get it to end? How do you get the ceasefire? Especially when one of the parties, Russia, is unwilling to stop fighting. Putin really believes that he can win.
Yeah.
When that is.
Yeah, we only have a minute left, and I just wanted, I wanted to end on Putin is 72 years old, and honestly, I thought he was older than that. He seems to, because he seemed to have been around forever. Does Putin have a successor, or does this end when he's no longer the leader?
There is no apparent successor. That I've been reading and looking and using my criminological skills to try to figure out if there's somebody there, but I don't see anybody. That doesn't mean there isn't someone, but the laws of biology are going to catch up with that guy for sure. And he looks robust and he acts robust, but he gets Botox shots. So that helps to eliminate the wrinkles. It's on no one that I can see.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking about the Russia-Ukraine war with Professor George Hudson, retired professor of political science at Wittenberg University. He also taught as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Ohio State University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I want to say thank you to our student producer, Colin Simpson, for producing this show today. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And if you missed any part of today's show, be sure to listen at wosu.org/allsides or subscribe to our podcast. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich.